Drawing's an instinctive activity, as fundamental a part of human life as breathing or eating. But it's an activity that has many functions. For fine artists, it can be about creating beauty. But for others, it's a vital and extremely precise tool. In this program, I'll be looking at drawing and design, and exploring some of the ways in which a number of extraordinary people, both in the past and today, have used drawing as an essentially practical art form, the crucial first step in the journey from imagination to reality. Right back to the origins of design drawing, in the Italian Renaissance, creative minds have grappled with how to reconcile fantasy and feasibility, the gap between what can be imagined on the page and what can actually be constructed in the world. My first stop's in the land of weird, on the edge of the Nevada desert, a place where fantasy and reality truly do come together, in the city of Las Vegas. I've come to meet someone who draws wild ideas, spectacles and creations. His name is Mark Fisher. I think of him as one of the most interesting inheritors of a vitally important drawing tradition, a strain of fantasy draftsmanship that has its origins in the Renaissance, yet has shaped our world in all kinds of fascinating and unpredictable ways.
I remember always being good at drawing and being encouraged to draw and doing a lot of drawing from life, drawing nature, drawing pretty much anything. And when I was at school, I was very lucky in having a fantastic art teacher who really encouraged me. And it was a great relief because I didn't like very much else of being at school.
Fisher's name won't be known to many people, but his work is known to millions all over the world as the creator of some of the most spectacular rock concert sets of the last 25 years for the Rolling Stones, Pink Floyd, and U2. Fisher's the man behind the scenes, the architect of rock and roll fantasy. But what he's done in Las Vegas is designed and built an extraordinary new venue for the phenomenally acrobatic theatre troupe, Cirque du Soleil. His original inspiration for the design of the theatre was a temple in Kyoto, Japan. His initial drawings look very similar to the temple's undercroft. His drawings are artworks in themselves, but to Mark, they're just a starting point, a blueprint for the long collaborative process between him and the designers and builders who will help him realize his dream.
How long does it take from conception, as it were, to you having an idea of what you actually want the theatre to look like?
When I'm lucky, it's kind of instant.
Where does the drawing, as it were, come in this process of visualization to realization?
More when I'm wanting to get it out of my head and into the heads of the people I'm talking to. Because these meetings are always groups of creative folk sitting around waving their arms about and thinking this and that and the other. And of course, words are one thing, but what we're actually in the process of doing is making a real, unambiguous physical object. And words are a very inadequate way of accurately describing what that might be. So one way, my way of working in meetings is to try and confirm as we go along, well, if this is what we're talking about, then is this what we're talking about?
Would something like this book actually turn up at one of your meetings, or is this?
This is a more likely sort of meeting level of sketch. This would be one, if I'm lucky. This is what the audience is seeing, and here's our floating stage. And
as a matter of interest, you know, when you confront an actual engineer, someone who's going to have to actually make this work with your drawing, do they sort of sometimes go, you've got to be kidding, we can't possibly do that?
Very rarely, I'm proud to say. I hope that somewhere in the background, when I was at a college and went to all those lectures about engineering, like something stuck, and I'm always very interested to see whether I get the sizes right. And usually within a few percent, I do. I have a good track record of not drawing things that are impossible.
And what a track record it is. Fisher specialises in turning huge spaces, usually sports venues, into fantasy lands for some of the world's biggest rock groups. Through his drawings, he can create a spectacle to stun and overwhelm the senses from pretty much any kind of environment.
Effectively, what we do is we take a stadium, which is not a music venue, it's a stadium built for sport, for athletics. We go in there, and in the space of maybe 16 hours before a show, we turn it into a concert venue. We do a show that lasts 2 hours, then we pack it all up again and take it out.
Mark's an architect by training, but he doesn't so much create buildings as environments. His work really falls somewhere between choreography and construction. His task as stage designer is to make a space where the relationship between performer and audience can be played out as dynamically as possible. The audience is physically involved, unlike that for, say, a classical concert. And everything on the stage, therefore everything Mark draws and designs, has to assist that interaction. All that he does starts as a sketch in one of his hundreds of sketchbooks. While still at college, he studied inflatable technology extensively and even designed his own blow-up suit. Here he is wearing it like some eccentric 70s cartoon superhero, Inflatable Architecture Man. Improbable as it might seem, his attachment to inflatables led to his first big break in 1977.
The first big concert that I did was when Pink Floyd had lost their pig. They were filming it at Battersea Power Station, and it notoriously flew away and landed, of course, in a pig farm out in Kent. And so I got a phone call, would I like to make some more inflatables?
Along with colleague Andrew Saunders, Mark got to work.
We made a bunch of inflatables called The Family, and then got into a mass production line of pigs. We made Hindenburg pigs. They were filled with helium and they went up into the air and blew up like the Hindenburg. So that was very nice. And we took them out on the summer tour for the Floyd in America in 1977, and that was really the moment when I ran away and joined the circus, I think.
We don't need no education.
In 1979, for Pink Floyd's The Wall tour, Fisher, Roger Waters and Jonathan Park built a vast wall on the stage, meant to represent an increasing sense of alienation between performer and audience. It served as a screen for the second half of the performance to project drawn animations by the cartoonist Gerald Scarfe. Once upon a time, the designer of this type of intricate fantasy spectacle would have been working for kings and queens. Mark's patrons are the modern equivalent of royalty, rock stars, whose huge wealth means there are few limits to what he can imagine. But unlike the patrons of the past, whose court entertainments were designed for the enjoyment of a very small, privileged elite, rock groups need to reach out to as many people as possible. So it's Mark's job to create a pageant for the people. His design for U2's Pop Mart show, with its arch references to mass consumerism, is an ironic celebration of pop culture. And as its central symbol, Mark set about creating the world's biggest TV screen. One of his most striking creations for U2 was the famous giant lemon that opened to reveal the band, or, on one occasion, failed to open, in a moment straight out of Spinal Tap.
Early in 97, I was talking with Willie Williams, the U2 show director, and I said, I've seen this LED screen, and you could take it and you could break it apart and take the pixels and move them so that what was a high-resolution screen became low-resolution but huge. And so we could make a screen as big as the end of a stadium. We did it pretty much first. I think it's still one of the biggest screens that's ever been toured.
For the Cirque du Soleil show in Vegas, the challenge is different. How to breathe new life into a traditional circus, dance and theatre pageant. Mark draws freehand with a fountain pen. No rubbing out, few mistakes. His technique's very spontaneous, but what's in his mind as he draws is a complex combination of things. He's thinking of scale, of mechanical engineering. And pretty much everything is done with an implied but exact sense of perspective in mind.
May I ask you if we could actually see you doing some drawing?
Okay. Well, what I can try and do is explain a bit of the mechanics of what you're going to see this evening. The big idea which we ended up with was that we could move the stage to present the performers to the audience as if they were watching one of these new action movies. And so I had to find a way of making a stage, if you imagine, same size as an ordinary West End stage, this rectangle. So somebody on it's about yay big. And the proposition is that this thing can move around in space. We put a turntable underneath it, and this turntable is on a cantilevering arm. And then this cantilevering arm is attached to a really long, thick tube. And this tube is mounted on a couple of gigantic things which we call the hammerheads. And these things are extraordinarily large when you get up close to them because they're as high as a semi-detached house. Stage can revolve on here in a circle. So it can also pitch into a vertical axis like this as it's moving, and all of these motions can happen continuously.
It might be a cliché, but I think Mark really is a bit of a Renaissance man. Artist, designer, architect. He thinks on a huge scale, incorporating flights of fantasy. And if he can draw it well enough to explain it to his technical team, pretty much anything is possible. As well as the theatre, stage and sets, Mark also designed many of the hugely ingenious props used in the show. After the sketches, he and his team turned them into computer models, both to show the clients their ideas and to show the builders so they can actually make them.
With the boat, I have a very, very strong feeling that I'm in the presence of a drawing that really has... It's so much like your drawing made into a solid object.
This was, for me, one of those absolutely serendipitous things where you draw something and then it becomes the drawing. And that doesn't happen very often. And it's a real pleasure when it does. And it took a lot of work by a lot of people because the technology of making this hull so hard was very, very difficult. This is aerospace
laminate technology to make this carbon fibre hull.
And it needs to be really hard so that they can get minimum friction.
So it doesn't take away any energy by being soggy as it rolls about. And then the whole shape of it, with these very expressive handrails. This end is the face. It has a bird's tail at the stern and the head here, and these handrails are like the Elvis quiff.
We're in Vegas.
These are the positions where people do individual things.
So this is where somebody who's going to perform, they actually start here.
They'll come in with a harness, climb down.
Sorry, I'll get vertigo.
And then they go. And here...
Having seen all the drawings and designs, I was curious about seeing it all come to life in the evening's performance. During the show, for all the high-tech machinery involved, I was struck by how timeless this spectacle actually seemed. I felt as though I could have been watching a Baroque masque staged for a 17th century king, or an entertainment fit for a Medici prince, complete with acrobats, witches and wizards, washed with a light smattering of allegory and symbolism. This might be Vegas, but it's not that far from Renaissance Italy. One of the things I like most about Fisher's work is its sense of history. I'd mentioned to him that his boat and flying machine reminded me of designs by Leonardo, and he'd said yes, that's exactly where they came from.
No coincidence that Mark Fisher, who I think of really as a 21st century Renaissance man, should have designed the spectacle through a series of drawings. Drawings that gave him a sense of scale, a sense of perspective, a sense of human placement within the spectacle as a whole. And if I had to identify one thing that runs through the tradition of design from the Renaissance to the present day, it is that line of drawing.
And there's no better place to start tracing that line linking past and present than the birthplace, in Italy, of the original Renaissance all-rounder.
Vinci's still a little town in the back of beyond, Smallsville, Tuscany, and it's part of the myth that's grown up around the town's most famous son, Leonardo da Vinci, that he was the genius who came from nowhere. But the truth is very different, and the fact is that Leonardo's great spreading oak tree of a mind branching out in all directions could only ever have flourished in 15th century Tuscany.
Leonardo's mind was inquiring, sceptical, profoundly speculative. You can see that mentality in the fertile pages of his sketchbooks.
And something else makes him very special. In the late 15th century in Italy, paper suddenly became much more plentiful, much cheaper. And Leonardo is really one of the first Renaissance men to go about the world with a notebook, jotting down his ideas, his designs. And that also means that he's the first great Western European artist-designer whose imagination we can actually see at work.
You can't understand Leonardo if you think of him as a pure artist in the modern sense. He created famously subtle portraits and religious paintings. But as a top court artist, he was expected to design the prince's fortifications, invent his army's weapons, and carry out 1,000 other tasks besides. The Vinci Museum shows his scatterfire imagination at work. One minute he's inventing a diving suit, the next he's working on an armoured car. There's even a wonderfully modern-looking bicycle in the reams and reams of his notebook sketches. His respect for nature as the ultimate designer is reflected in his most famous invention, that for a flying machine, based on the structure of a peregrine falcon's wings. But although Leonardo took first steps in all sorts of directions, most of his ideas would be unrealizable in his lifetime. The materials, technology, and engineering expertise to make them happen simply hadn't evolved. They were destined to lie dormant in the ground, acorns that sometimes wouldn't sprout for centuries.
One of Leonardo's most caustic later critics described him as an intellectual libertine who wasted his life insatiate in experiment. But I think that's also what's so endearing about him. He's the great patron saint of the mad inventor, the dreamer, the adventurous, unconventional thinker. And he paved the way for centuries of speculative design.
But Leonardo is only part of Renaissance Italy's legacy to the design tradition. Just as important was another Renaissance man, whose every design, by contrast, was intensely practical. Where Leonardo loved thinking outside the box, this great thinker created the rules for staying within it. Most importantly, perhaps, he recognized that in order for a drawing to become the blueprint for something real and buildable, it had to be drawn in accurate, three-dimensional perspective.
Interestingly, it wasn't a painter who devised the first system for drawing in true perspective, but an architect-engineer, an ingegnere, to use the Renaissance phrase, a man of ingenuity. His name was Filippo Brunelleschi, Pippo to his friends, and his claim to fame was that he designed and constructed the great dome of Florence Cathedral. But it wasn't enough for Brunelleschi to have created this architectural wonder of the world. He was determined to place the principles of rational design at the very heart of Renaissance thinking. Brunelleschi's tactic was to stage a public demonstration of his new big idea. He came to this spot. To be precise, he stood three braccia, or arm's lengths, inside the door of Florence Cathedral, and he painted a picture of the baptistry opposite.
The painting's lost, but it was so perspectivally accurate that it changed the world of art and design forever. Such was its impact that the mathematical techniques involved were formalized, written down, and illustrated, so the secret became common knowledge. A key figure in this process was Piero della Francesca. He was born a generation after Brunelleschi and wasn't just one of the greatest artists of the early Renaissance, but also a man who realized, like his predecessor, the potential of mathematics. The story goes that he would stay up working on these obsessively diagrammatic drawings and studies all night. And when his wife called him to come to bed, Piero would just call out that he was spending the night with his mistress, Lady Perspective. The technique's appeal to painters was obvious, but its importance for designers and architects, for people whose drawings had to be actually made into real things, was even greater. I think of the design tradition, especially in architecture, as having a bit of a split personality. On the one hand, there are the Brunelleschis and the Christopher Wrens of this world, the men who get it done, who build the great domes and other city landmarks, even the cities themselves. But just as important are the Leonardos, more impractical perhaps, but vital as catalysts, seeding the ideas and designs that will one day shape the future. I went to meet Charles Hind, curator of drawings at the Royal Institute of British Architects at the V&A's Architectural Gallery, a treasure trove both of practical architectural drawings and fantasy projects. Its collections span the built, the yet-to-be-built, and the just-plain-unbuildable.
We've got the majority of Palladio's surviving drawings.
Oh, wow, that's fantastic.
The drawings were a much more valuable resource because they do show more than just a sort of design record of buildings as built, but they do show him working ideas.
They show
through.
You how to do it.
They show you how to do it.
Palladio was the leading practical architect of Renaissance Venice, the Venetian equivalent to Brunelleschi, if you like. His great achievement was to apply the language of classical architecture, revived during the early Renaissance, to the domestic house, specifically the villa. This is just one of a whole series of Palladio drawings, which collectively transformed not just Italian, but also British architecture. Brought here in the time of Charles I, they inspired generations of British architects to build pillared and pedimented country houses up and down the land, as well as whole classical city plans, like that of Edinburgh. To put it simply, they changed the way Britain looked forever. But while Palladio's drawings had a huge impact on the physical landscape, there are other less functional drawings in the collection that had just as big an impact on the mental landscape. Fantasy designs, impractical perhaps, but they still altered the texture of the Western European imagination.
For example, with the Sydney Opera House by Jorn Utzon, most critics thought that Utzon's great shells were actually unbuildable, and it was actually his engineer, Ove Arup, who actually worked out how to make them.
Where Palladio clearly followed in the logical, buildable Brunelleschi school of design, Utzon could be said to lean more towards the fantasy Leonardo school. Charles also let me see some of his currently unexhibited treasures, many of which really take you to the heart of the creative process, showing how architects have used different types of drawing to plan the different stages of their building projects, but also how, sometimes, they've simply drawn as a way of thinking or dreaming out loud. First of all, we saw some of the functional drawings.
Here's
one you prepared earlier.
Here's one I prepared earlier. Three drawings by an architect called Colin Campbell. Here you've got a house which, in fact, he built down in Kent called Merriwith Castle, which is modelled closely on Palladio's Villa Rotonda in Vicenza.
Those are beautiful. Is that actually a drawing?
That's a drawing, yes. It looks remarkably like an engraving.
It does, doesn't
it? It's beautifully done in pen and grey ink and grey washes.
Then came the bit I have to admit I'd been waiting for, a close-up look at some of the historical masters of architectural fantasy, the French architect Boulez and the Italian draftsman Piranesi.
This is one of a series of etchings of fantasy prisons. It's a sort of nightmarish scene of...
This is what Goya would have done if he'd been an architectural draftsman, these sort of dark fantasy images. They're absolutely fantastic.
I mean, lots of sort of hurried, busy little lines. Very little detail. Everybody's sort of seen half buried in gloom, and you can't really make much out about the figures, except that there's a general air of sort of suffering and pain.
Piranesi was an architect and stage designer, whose greatest drawings were these architectural capricci, or caprices, his folios like a crazed romantic novel in picture form, unfolding in scene after scene of alienated pygmies dwarfed by vast classical structures. His drawings were created just decades before the French Revolution and looked like apt symbols of an absolutist regime that had to be toppled, a dark, repressive Bastille that had to be stormed. Piranesi might have been a fantasy architect, but he remodeled the way people thought about their world.
This is, if you like, a dark side of fantasy. Mm. If you go, think of this as basement stuff.
Basement.
And then if you walk upstairs, then you come to something like this. This is Boulez, Louis-Étienne Boulez. And you can imagine this extraordinary metropolitan cathedral. He thought of this as crowning the skyline of Paris. I mean, the scale is stupendous, and the figures down on down at the floor are completely dwarfed by these gigantic columns and these vast, presumably masonry vaults.
Boulez, the French architect, is best known for his fantasies, which I think of as a kind of solution to the Piranesi nightmare. These drawings show how life should be when the brave new republic is founded, a temple for the masses, a place of light and space and spiritual uplift for all.
This is a wonderful drawing again in the sense that he's used the techniques of watercolour to create aerial perspective, that sense that things get misted by distance, so that you really feel that this building is so enormous that you can't actually see to the end of it because it's sort of, there are clouds forming. I mean, what's implicit in a drawing like this, it seems to me, is the idea of, so to speak, architecture exceeding itself. And let's not just design a building, let's design a way of life, let's design a whole city.
The very idea of reconfiguring the city itself goes back to the Renaissance, to Piero della Francesca, who painted this picture of an eerily depopulated ideal town centre in the late 15th century. And to Leonardo, whose schemes included this fantasy redesign of Milan on two levels, the upper carriageway for the nobility, with the plebs kept to the underground tunnels. The British have always been a bit suspicious of flights of architectural fantasy, but there's been the odd exception, and Charles introduced me to a wonderful fantasist by the name of Charles Walcott.
This was a slightly loony scheme by Walcott, which proposed diverting the River Thames round central London. And the bed of the Thames through central London was laid out as a sort of imperial way.
This is the horse racing thing in ancient Rome.
Yes,
What's it called? The hippodrome.
Yeah. It goes on...
That beats Sandown Park, doesn't it?
Now, at this point, you would hit something that's recognisable, because that's County Hall, and that's the Palace of Westminster and Westminster Abbey.
When was this done?
1934.
This was a sort of half-jokey scheme for completely redesigning London.
Yes.
But nonetheless, it's at exactly the same period when you've got the beginning of the utopian city movement, isn't it, in the 1930s? Isn't that when people really begin thinking about cities as entire architectural projects?
The tradition of fantasy architecture was forced necessarily into retreat during the Second World War. But by the time the 1960s came around, it made a spectacular comeback. And in fact, some of the most influential architectural designs of the whole second half of the 20th century were produced by a bunch of guys who built almost nothing. What they did do was draw, but for them, lines weren't just lines, they were grooves in the social fabric.
Can you direct us to the Bureau of the Archigram Organisation?
Scientific knowledge is doubling every 9 years. 90% of all scientists who ever lived are alive today.
Archigram thinks architects should stop making bigger and better boxes and get down to the real business of architecture today, which they think is survival.
There were six of them, they were based in London, and they called themselves Archigram. They drew schemes for extraordinary projects, such as entire cities and buildings made of components that can be plugged in, swung and floated into place, and could even rise on large mechanical legs, like giant insects. I went to meet one of the original members of this architectural brat pack, Dennis Crompton.
Do you think of drawing as a language? I mean, is that what you think it is, essentially?
Yes, it is language, yes. Yeah, I mean, basically, we all have thoughts in our heads, and we all have to talk to other people about those thoughts. And the way that we talk is through what is generally, to me, language.
What are we looking at here? We're looking at some ground plans. And the idea for the building was that everything could actually be moved around.
All the elements on this drawing are all movable.
Yeah.
So if you cleared those away, all you'd have is an empty space of that sort of diameter with a service space running around the side of it. Some of the things, like the toilets, were poked into the service space. And there were things like concert or recital rooms set up in here, exhibition, the audiovisual exhibition, another exhibition of modern art has been set up there.
At first sight, this drawing reminded me of a Ludo board, but it's actually a free-form ground plan for a theatre and entertainment complex. Just the sort of archigram drawing that has inspired Mark Fisher, who studied with the group.
This is one of your own ground plans, but you've slightly begun to...
Well, it's right at the very beginning.
...look more at human activity in the space just the space
itself.
Right. So there's some very 60s people behaving in a very laid-back, groovy 60s way.
This is the way it was, yes.
But again, I suppose this isn't... I shouldn't take this too literally, is that right? This isn't really a design for a building so much as a kind of attitude, a picture of an attitude towards
space.
Well,
if you were talking to one of these young ladies about what you would provide for them in terms of their domestic accommodation, then showing them something like this would help them to understand how they might occupy it.
Rent a wall. It's a good concept. So the idea is that you can, in a sense, you can change the nature of the space that you live in so that your house almost becomes a cross between a building and a theatre.
Yes.
So that you can be in a Gothic mood one day, or you could be in an Indian-style mood the next day.
Yeah. Once you accept the concept that the dwelling is changeable, there's no limit to what it might be changed into. And the only limitation is your own imagination.
The reason they included collage and lots of colour was to escape from the rather straight-laced traditions of architectural drawing, which they thought alienated the public and communicated only to other architects. Archigram wanted to draw everyone into their world. Archigram pushed the speculative tradition of architecture to extremes, conceptually and technologically. But over the years, their influence has been visible in many a landmark modern building. Richard Rogers' Pompidou Centre in Paris and Lloyd's building in London, with their plumbing, electrical systems and even lifts exposed like a body's innards, are just two examples of how the Archigram project turned architecture, quite literally, inside out. Similarly, many of the most celebrated architects of the last decade became, like Archigram, internationally famous without building anything. Their drawings were their calling cards. Zaha Hadid emerged from this tradition. Her futuristic early drawings and paintings look a bit like illustrations for science fiction novels. This is one of her current projects, the Fino Science Center in Wolfsburg, Germany, still under construction. Drawing has been at the heart of its every stage. Her early sketches look a bit like doodles, ideas for shapes and forms and contours. But with the help of the latest computer technology, Hadid is able to produce detailed animated versions of fully realized architectural plans and elevations, a virtual illustrated tour of the finished building. Another architect at the leading edge of this technological synthesis of speculation and actual construction is Ron Arad, whose design and architectural work seethes with the energy of modern art. But whilst drawing is still at the heart of everything he creates, by also using computer design software, his forward-thinking designs stand a chance of actually making it into reality.
I always thought, as an arrogant student, that you can only design what you can draw. You know, if you can't draw, how can you design? It's different now with computers, because you can design things that you couldn't possibly draw.
Ron was very influenced in his early days both by Mark Fisher and by Archigram. As the possibilities of architecture and design opened up with new tools and materials, so Arad's designs have mutated and evolved, constantly adapting to an ever-changing technological environment. But like any architect hoping to stay at the forefront of his field, he's had to change the way he works very noticeably during his career.
In the old days, there was, you know, the drawings and then the drafting, the technical drawings. And then there used to be the artisans, the model makers that make the prototypes. Now with computers and computer drawings and computer models, there's no middlemen.
The computer really has transformed design, and it's perhaps the biggest difference between the world Leonardo lived in and the world that Ron Arad lives in now. Using its power, he and his team of architects can turn a sketch relatively painlessly into a 3D computer model and fully detailed architectural plans. I met Jeff Crowther, one of Ron's most senior architects. It's part of his job to create a solid framework within which the clients and the architects can both work together.
We'll spend a lot of time exchanging information, exchanging letters, saying, questions, is this what you want? And then they'll say, no, this is how we want it. And it boils down, at the end, to something as concise and almost schematic as possible.
And is that your starting point, or have you already, by this point, had a drawing from Ron?
Generally, we'll start with this, because the problem with just sketching in a purely creative way is potentially quite wasteful.
Too disengaged from the needs.
Too disengaged, and you could end up with something beautiful and fantastic, and you look at it, but you just can't make it work.
The first schematic diagram is turned into a picture of basic building blocks, purely to show how the building might function.
When does Ron get his hands on it?
This is where Ron and the team of architects will work very closely together. So this is one of the critical moments in bringing the more conceptual, sketchy side of it into this very dry building block side of it. We don't use traditional mediums, so it's not using pencils and paper. Ron has a sketch pad, which is a digital sketching pad.
I was surprised that Ron's sketch comes at this stage, when lots of practical decisions have already been made. So although these sketches may look like fantasy, there's a lot of practical information already contained within them.
What happens after that sketch?
This is the starting to sketch in 3D work. So Ron and the team will be working together, and you'll be starting to just move things around in three dimensions to start to get an understanding of how you want to build this thing.
For all that that's on a computer and it shows a very space-age building, to me, it's still essentially a Renaissance perspective drawing.
Yes, but the difference is that instead of being a single point of view, we have infinite points of view. It can be viewed from any place, so that we can move through the building, we can turn it upside down, we can turn it inside out even.
I'd assumed that was the end of it. How much more sophisticated could it get? But I was again surprised to learn that the final stage was what looked like simple, old-fashioned, two-dimensional drawings.
So your builders and engineers and the people who have to construct the building itself, they still end up with traditional plan, section, elevation, architectural drawings.
Mm-hmm. That's right, absolutely.
Is this produced by an engineer or
No, this is produced by us as architects. Yeah. So this is traditional architectural output. This is the way that architects have, you know, for hundreds of years described a building. Mm. And it's the way we probably will continue to describe buildings for quite a long time, is in two-dimensional pieces of paper.
The information available to Ron and Jeff on the computer is pretty much instantaneous. Can the tensile strength of a particular metal sustain that level of curve? Will glass panels stay in with a given wind force? And so on. None of this information was available to Leonardo, and I can't help wondering what he'd have achieved with this level of backup. Having seen the process by which Ron's ideas turn into something buildable, I was struck by just how much the computer enables architects to tackle at once. Ron's project seemed to be everywhere.
I'm in the middle of one that is, for me, it's already a piece in its own right, which is the Battersea Power Station. Yes, there are some archigram elements there. Yes, there is a bit of walking city in there. There's lots of, like, you know, what technology can do to spaces. And look, we are living in a new century and all that. It's there.
The hotel proposed for the top of London's Battersea Power Station is a typically way-out Ron Arad project, clearly continuing in the tradition of fantasy architectural drawing. It reminds me of the space-age designs of Archigram in the 60s, but I also think there are distant echoes here of the monumental labyrinthine fantasies of Piranesi. We've seen how technology and computers transform the drawings of people like Mark Fisher and Ron Arad into a high-tech, high-budget world of construction. But not every field of design is so dependent on technology. From the days of the Renaissance, when beautiful clothes were available only to the very privileged, up to now, when designer copies are available to all on the high street, the methods of fashion design remain pretty much the same. Here in the V&A's Fashion Gallery, they have an exhibition of the extensive wardrobe of Queen Maud of Norway, clearly a woman with a dress to suit every occasion and pretty much every fantasy. Now, fashion is where fantasy design really comes into its own. And one of the things I like about this display is the way in which it shows you how each and every one of these fabulous haute couture creations started life, essentially, as a drawing. The drawings are intricate artworks, usually done in pencil and watercolour. The process remains pretty much identical today. From Queen Maud's couturiers in the 1800s, right up to now, drawings have always been the mainstay of the fashion industry. Animations in this video of Kate Moss and Primal Scream are the work of fashion designer Julie Verhoeven. First and foremost, she's an artist who loves to draw. What she draws, and for whatever reason, comes second. A lot of her filigree yet curiously savage work is loosely called fashion illustration.
Wad of preliminary drawings. So they were basically drawings in splodgy ink of butterflies and sweet things and then nasty things like panthers and beetles and crows. And so the two were layered in rapid succession.
Julie's drawings of erotically charged Lolitas and pixie princesses are an idea of beauty that she imagines in her head. They're a kind of idealised fantasy world that she expresses through drawing, but she's lived in her mind, since she was a young girl.
When I was little and I used to draw, I would, you know, very much escape to my bedroom and close the door and have the radio on and just draw and draw and draw. And little has changed since, other than I could have the music a lot louder now. I had, you know, big dreams of becoming a fashion designer.
The strength of her youthful drawing caught the eye of one of fashion's biggest names.
When I was at Galliano's, it was great because he, you know, he's a fantastic drawer himself and really loves it. Then I'd show my work to John, and from that moment on, he kind of started using me much more for my drawing. So I've got off the hand sewing, thank God.
Then Marc Jacobs asked her to produce a bag for Louis Vuitton, and she started collaborating on collections with the Italian label Gibo, and finally, her own label. The process she follows to design a collection starts with research, developing a general theme, looking at pictures and seeing what takes her fancy.
This phase could take, I'll probably do about 3 to 4 intensive days of purely photocopying. And then I would stop, then I'd start the collection, and then I'd sort of revert back to it later on in the season when I need to sort of revise my thoughts. Well, I was just looking at sort of at random to start with. I didn't know quite what I was looking for. And then I found the Good Luck Charms, which I really, really like. So I just sort of went in that direction. And then the sinister undertones, it's just something I can't get away from. Well, it's the sort of mood of the collection. So it's Lift Up Your Skirt and Fly, which feels very optimistic, but with this sort of sinister undertone. And it's all based on good luck charms and omens and the supernatural.
After weeks of accumulating a mass of visual stimuli, she puts all her ideas together as drawings. She barely takes the pen off the page because, she says, she doesn't want to break the line of her thought.
So this is a good example of how I begin to start sketching. I'll begin with a seductive face that is, on the face of it, quite pretty. And as I work down the body, I tend to react to that character and give it a little bit of a twist in some way or another. I tend to alternate between pen, pencil and crayon just in the hope that I make another mark that might provoke another reaction and suggest another fabric or applique or some special treatment. So it's a purposeful thing, but I just hope again for a happy accident.
Just as Ron Arad's concepts are realised through Jeff and his team, so Julie calls in her own technical backup, in the form of her pattern cutter, George Ormerod. And,
so this is the dress that I'd like you to work on. It's going to be in this Pandora print. It's basically coming from the four-leaf clover idea.
Right.
Very randomly yeah. placed. And no finishing, to feel as unstructured as possible.
Right.
And, kind of 1920s flapper type feeling, sort of Peter Pan in panto.
Working from Julie's sketches, he comes up with a basic paper pattern. Then he cuts a dress from a simple fabric, which they fit on a mannequin. He's drawing too, but with a pair of scissors as well as a pen. Constant reference back to the original designs, the dress gradually takes shape. At this point, a model, Katia, arrives, and Julie can see how the dress hangs and moves for real. Looking at her final catwalk show is seeing Julie's drawings walk, live and breathe. Her drawing, with its swirls and colours, really is at the heart of what she does. Fashion designers like her are the exception to the new 21st century design tradition in not using a computer at any stage of the process. And although that's proof that computers aren't essential to successful modern design, they're the biggest difference between the Renaissance and today.
One of my favourite passages from Leonardo da Vinci's notebooks is a set of restlessly scribbled notes to himself. He writes, "Ask Maestro Antonio how they place mortars on battlements. Find out from Benedetto Portinari how men go on the ice in Flanders. Seek out a master of mathematics and get him to show you how to find the square of a triangle," and so on. Leonardo is a restless hunter-gatherer of information because he knows that design is an intellectually collaborative process and that any one piece of information from any one of these different sources may at some point prove to be the key to a particular design problem. And that, in essence, was how design developed over centuries.
But with the computer, the gap between fantasy and reality has never been narrower, because computers can organise vast pools of knowledge and synthesise organic ideas with high technology. So does this spell the end for design drawing? Actually, I think the opposite's true.
Ever since the days of Brunelleschi and Leonardo da Vinci, architects, engineers, designers of all kinds have expressed themselves first and most freshly through the medium of drawing. And although the computer is a fantastically powerful design tool, it's worth remembering that even the most sophisticated computer is only as sophisticated as the mind that designed it. The relationship between the designing mind and the draftsman's hand, the link between the imagination and drawing, that's a line, a thread, that will never be broken.
And for more on how drawing has shaped our world, go to bbc.co.uk/arts. Next tonight, a taster of BBC Two's major new series, Rome, which starts on Wednesday. Inside Rome, in a moment.